C1T. Number 2B.
Now we come to the general subject of the chapter, as we have seen. It is really showing now that Christian Science, or teaching Christian Science, that the caption in the middle of the page, that teaching Christian Science demands strict adherence to the divine principle. And that if we really can conform to that, then that has within itself the wisdom to unfold more and more and more. Now, with that caption of the whole textbook, we have given, so to say, the tone of the theme, namely strict adherence to, the synonymous term. Therefore, that whole chapter is built up through the seven subjects of mind, spirit, soul, principle, life, truth, and love, in seven subjects that all have that same common denominator, namely that same common denominator of strict adherence. Therefore, if you take the epitomes, and we just read quickly these epitomes that are referring to the synonymous term and are printed here in bold letters, we run through it just for one purpose, not to explain them, but just to see how I tried as nearly as possible always to use the same stereotyped rendering so as to keep the tonality always on a pure line and show how each subject just is a variation of that general theme. So in mind, see, we had here that teaching Christian Science demands strict adherence to the wise leadings of mind. See, it's mind now. Strict adherence to mind. What does that do? And the second part of the epitome then always shows what this involves. This involves pure motives in teaching and healing, so that we can see what is involved in the strict adherence to a principle. And naturally, that what is involved in the strict adherence to a synonymous term, that is always characterized then through the synonymous term. So in spirit, you have again the stereotyped rendering, teaching Christian Science demands strict adherence now to the purity of spirit. We are now in spirit. What does that involve? This involves the overcoming of evil and the practicing of good, because spirit is symbolized always through good versus evil. In soul, again, teaching Christian Science demands strict adherence to what now? To the divine rules of soul. What does that involve? This involves protection from malpracticing and malpractice. Then principle again, the same stereotyped rendering, teaching Christian Science demands strict adherence to the divine principle. What does that involve? It involves absolute trust in the omnipotence of principle. Life, that teaching Christian Science demands strict adherence to life. What does that involve? It involves a scientific method of practice and not quackery. You know, the method of life is life. In truth, teaching Christian Science demands strict adherence to truth. What does that involve? This involves the consciousness of a Christian and a scientist. And finally, the tone of love, that teaching Christian Science demands strict adherence to the motherhood of love. What does that involve? The mother root of love is expressed here through accepting divine self-completeness. So with this, I just wanted to bring out the method of how we can always somehow epitomize the main subjects of a chapter. And naturally, we must see that it is not enough just to see that a chapter is built up along an ordered line, here along the ordered line of the Word of God, the ordered line of mind, spirit, soul, principle, life, truth, and love. We must also see that within that ordered line there must be a common denominator that is expressed in this way, that each of those seven subjects will symbolize always the one and the same thing. Here it is strict adherence to the synonymous term. And in this way, you can see that when you compare then afterwards one chapter with other chapters, and other chapters may be built up again in the word order, as we have seen. So it isn't so much the word order that is of greatest interest for the comprehension of a chapter, but it's much more actually the way these seven synonymous terms are used, or perhaps even better, which aspect of the seven synonymous terms are being brought out. And only through that we get a really differentiation from one chapter to the other chapter. So that the seven synonymous terms in the chapter on prayer have a completely different aspect than in the chapter on Dominant Eucharist. And again, a different aspect, the same seven, in the chapter on marriage, and so on through all the chapters. And that therefore it is the aspect of the seven synonymous terms that are really that which characterizes a chapter and is important for the chapter, and which therefore is that which we should investigate properly. Perhaps a side remark on these epitomes. You know, in the Bible, we have various documents that are woven into each other. We have the Javistic document, we have the Eloistic document, we have the Deuteronomy document, we have the priestly document, and then various other documents and so on. And they were all somehow interwoven into the whole Old Testament. But today, through biblical criticism, we can again find out which part of the Bible belongs to the Jewistic document, which had belonged to the Eloistic document and to priestly document. How could they find out that? Just to that very thing, through the way each document treated the subject differently, through the tonality, really through the approach, through the language with which they treated the same historical facts in a different way. Now, one of those documents is characterized by their stereotyped way of writing, and that's the priestly document. And the priestly document is that document which really contains really the most scientific presentation of the subject. As for instance, the 7 days of creation. And there again you can see the 7 days of creation in Genesis came from the priestly document, and they used that stereotyped way because they were much more scientific thinkers than the Jewistic and the Eloistic writers. And what did they do? They used that stereotyped way of starting every day the same way, and God said, let there be, and then afterwards God made it, and then afterwards God looked at it, it was very good, and this was the first day. After the first day, start all over again the same stereotyped way, and God said, let there be, and he made it, and he looked at it, it was very good, and this was the second day, and so on. So, I like to use that kind of stereotyped rendering, because it enables us really to put the facts of being into laws, into strict laws. And the law, as you know, is fixed, and you can't change the formula of a law. You only can substitute an element in the law with certain data, with certain values, you see, but the law itself always remains the same. If Christian Science is a science, we naturally should see the laws of this textbook. And this we can find out much easier if we really try to reduce the text into such a way that they bring out certain definite orders and definite laws. And naturally, the language for that has to adapt itself to it. So I say that because very often a student who is new says, oh, this is just like a formula, and we shouldn't use formula, as Mrs. Eddy says, you see. But this has nothing to do with that. It's and so many students would rather like a flowery sense, and every epitome would be absolutely different and inspirational, and I don't know what, anything else but scientific. The moment we try to see the science of the textbook, then we also have to use a different language. We cannot use a flowery language, a prosaic, poetic language. We have to use a very strict scientific language with exact terminology and with exact place values, and therefore here you have these stereotyped epitomes. That was a side remark, but perhaps necessary for those who are new. So now we go and investigate together the first subject of mind. We have here the main epitome that teaching Christian Science demands strict adherence to the wise leadings of mind. Here mind is shown as that which leads and guides. So we should have that ethic that says, I give up all my personal sense of leadings and guidings and opinions, and I adhere strictly to the divine mind, and let mind guide me. Well, this involves pure motives in teaching and healing. You know, motives is an idea of mind when it is translated to the human level. The wisdom of mind, the guiding of mind, translates itself to a human level and appears within us really as pure motives. So this is the overall tone, and we can ask ourselves now, what did Mrs. Eddy want to teach us, really, how to have good motives, or how to measure if we have good motives, what is meant with these good motives, what is involved in good motives. And the moment you ask these questions about a epitome, like here, then you can answer them only through the subtones. So we have here seven subtones, namely, we answer now this motive of mind by viewing it from the standpoint of mind, and then of spirit, and then of soul, and then principle, life, truth, and love. So that we have pure motive then, when a motive corresponds with the whole of God. Verse 7. And this is naturally a terrific help, say that if we know, and I think this is a well-known fact, not even in Christian Science, but all over the world, that motives is all that matters, that if motives are not right, then everything will be wrong. We must start with right motives. But then the question always comes up and says, but what are right motives? Here, human ethics may come in, and human ethics may say, well, a good motive is this, and a good motive is that. But we have seen yesterday that we should not rely on human ethics, but really on the divine ethics, where we let the seven synonymous term define to us what a good motive is. All right, again, if we have an epitome here, a main tone epitome, namely, like here, that we have to, that this involves pure motives in teaching and healing, then we can ask, this is a question then, what does that imply? What does that demand? That's a question. And when we want to answer such a question, we have to show it through all the seven, or it is not a complete answer. All right, now, what is the answer? And so we start with the text, and the text begins to answer it first from the point of view of mind. We have here the subtone epitome of mind, which says that this demands what? To be tolerant with adherence of medicine while having confidence in the wise leadings of omnipotent mind. You can detect here mind as mind. We have now the motive that asks us from the point of view of mind, first that we should be tolerant, and in that tolerance really have confidence in the wise leadings of the divine mind, and not in our opinions. So you have a wonderful sense of mind as mind, which says your true motive is there when you are not fighting and arguing with each other and with everyone who has another belief or who has another religion or another sense of healing. Don't argue with them, be tolerant, let them have what they have. But something more is necessary, because that would just be human ethics. Divine ethics says, but you also must have within yourself the conviction, the confidence that each one is led by the divine mind. That it's not our job to guide him personally with our motives, with our concepts of what he should do and not do, but let the divine mind mold him and fashion him according to the leadings of mind. Can you see the tone of mind as mind? When you read the text here, it's a bit a longish text, then if you ask yourself now, what are the questions that Mrs. Eddy brings up, where we should have a kind of a tolerance and a trust in the leadings of mind, you can easily see that she takes up three different questions regarding healing. So she picks out the subject of healing and how we should be tolerant in this question. There are three questions. The first question, I first quickly point out the question, then I go back to each one of them. The very first question is a question that arises so often with us, which says, well, should a Christian Scientist, in order to heal, be able to heal better, also have some kind of a medical knowledge and study medicine? The second question which he brings up is this, that he says, but if a Christian Scientist who is working with Christian Science to solve his healing problem, and then at one point comes to that point that they feel, I really should take a doctor and go on with the doctor, how should you treat such a patient? Again, a question. Then a third question is, but if a Christian Scientist tries his best to heal himself only with Christian Science and he doesn't succeed, so what? So what then? What should he do? These are the three questions. You see, they are somehow in a line. And so let's go back quickly to these three questions and see how Mrs. Eddy would deal with them. The first question would be, should a Christian Scientist who is engaged in healing, should he also have some kind of a medical knowledge? Should the Christian Science study medicine? Should he undergo a systematical medical study, she asks, or take a course of medical study? Can you hear? You go through the text and you ask yourself, what is the question that is involved here? Not so much try to understand the sentence and each sentence and one sentence after the other. First you have to read the whole paragraph and ask yourself, what is the common denominator there? What is the subject about which Mrs. Eddy writes here? And here you see it is this question of should we have a medical knowledge? And so her answer is here that we should have entire confidence in an omnipotent mind as really possessing all power. So she starts out and says, no, this is not necessary. Actually, you should only rely on mind as the only medicine, as possessing all power and not to resort to any corporeal means. But then comes in the tolerance and says, but all are really privileged to work out their own salvation according to their light. And you can see again the tone of mind as the light of mind that she says, let everybody alone and work it out according to his or her own light. Don't impose on anybody that he has to work it out with the divine mind. Let everybody free and be tolerant and judge not. Judge not. Leave the individual free to resort to whatever other system they fancy will afford relief. Can you see that big tolerance? It's not that dogmatic sense that we feel that we have to impose on our patients or on our family or our friends that they should drop right away medicine and that they should only rely on the divine mind. Let them leave to the guidings of divine mind. That's the tolerance here in that first question. The second question which he brings up, we have seen, is, but what happens if a patient fails to experience the healing power of Christian Science, and if he feels that he would be more benefited by taking refuge to medical treatment, what should we do at that point? Again, she gives that tolerant attitude. She doesn't say, well, you talk him out of it. You better talk him out of it. You better give him hell and say, you know what happens if you go on to the doctor and if you go into hospital, you just go into the hands of the devil and you miss your salvation and so on. No, she said, if that patient feels that he's benefited by leaving Christian Science, go to the doctor, let him go, but also let your treatment go. Don't treat him anymore. Therefore, here, the mind physician should give up such a case. So then, when that patient doesn't get help from the material medicine, then that very failure may be the guidings of the divine mind that may open his eyes, as she says, that opens his eyes, his blind eyes. See again, mind leading, revealing, enlightening, so she can see there may be a method of the divine mind to let him go to the doctor and find out if the doctor really gives him that relief and that help which that patient thinks the doctor could give or not. Because sooner or later he will have to realize and awake to the fact that only mind is a real help. So that suffering, she says, is often the divine agent in this elevation. Then there is the third question. Now, what shall we do if a patient fails to receive aid from Christian Science, if he relies completely on Christian Science and just wouldn't think of taking another means of healing, but still he goes worse and worse and worse, and it seems that nothing can help him? What shall he do then? This is another question that comes up over and over in the practice. If he fails to receive aid from other scientists, and then comes the wise answer of Mrs. Eddy, very wise answer. She says, God will still guide him to the right use of temporary and eternal means. Can you see that she shows here the case is never, there is always a resolution, a way out. But at that point, one has to have that tolerance against for oneself, that one really lets divine mind guide us into the right use, into the right, not into the wrong use, of temporal and eternal means. Meaning, what we always see in such cases, that if we then put away the whole issue and subject ourselves or submit ourselves to the divine mind and say to the divine mind, now show us the way, show us what has to be done, and not restrict ourselves just to the eternal means, but to see that mind can translate itself also to the use of temporal means, that we are willing to accept that. And therefore, at this point, it isn't a question, shall we go to the doctor or not to the doctor, to the hospital or not to the hospital? And then at that point, the question is, are we going to the divine mind and let divine mind guide us to the right use of what we have to do? Well, God is our refuge and strength. God is a very present help in trouble. Can you hear the tone of mind?